This week's Supreme Court decision in the case known as Janus v. AFSCME is expected to have a far-reaching impact on the union movement in America, but observers disagree as to what that impact will be. To some, it's a much-needed adjustment to the ways unions operate. To others, it's a critical blow to the future of organized labor and to collective bargaining. The decision states that public sector employees who are not union members cannot be required to pay the so-called agency fees that are taken out of their paychecks. We're speaking with two union representatives this morning, starting with Bobby Lee, the president of the Hawaii Firefighters Association.
For members, it's called dues, and for non-members, it's called an agency fee because we still represent them. So it's basically all the union costs excluding political action monies.
What's the rationale behind that?
Well, it, basically because we are the exclusive representative. You know, there's a cost to doing business. We negotiate contracts for them. We file grievances for the members all the way up to arbitration if we have to. And that's all, you know, cost that the union bears. And so it's basically cost for doing business. It's the services that we provide, you know, every member.
Well, according to this Supreme Court decision, you will no longer be able to collect those what have been called fair share fees, right?
That's what I believe this whole case was about. Non-members not wanting to pay any kind of agency fee or service fee or dues.
Yeah, that was the person who brought the suit was an Illinois public worker who specifically said that, you know, that and he, I believe, directed his objection to the political activities of the union.
Yes, that's what I believe so. And I think that's where the argument was. It was a question of what is political. And I think, like on our side, there's clear political monies that we do deal with, which really isn't much, you know. But I think the argument on the other side was that, well, everything the union does is political.
Well, yeah, just to, you know, to play devil's advocate, you know, if I'm a member of the union, or if I'm a fair share fee paying, you know, employee, and the union endorses a candidate other than the one I want, that you know, I would see why somebody might have an argument there.
Sure, and you know, like I said, I understand the argument they have too, but at the same time. You know, when a member or a non-member goes into the voting booth, they vote for who they want, you know, and we understand that.
What kind of impact do you expect this decision to have on your union?
I don't think it's going to impact us very much. Currently, we have 100% membership. We don't have any non-members per se, and we've been kind of dealing with this issue to some degree for decades. We represent fire captains on down to the recruits. And once a member becomes an excluded manager, which is battalion chief and above, we no longer represent them. They don't have to be a member. But the vast majority of our chief officers statewide still retain membership. You know, for us, being part of the union is like family. It's our culture, and we do everything we can to help the chief officers, you know, whether they wanted to be a member or not. But for the most part, the vast majority of our chief officers choose to be members.
Have you had those who do not choose, have you had over the years, you know, some pushback from them along these lines?
No, not at all, because as far as the members we represent, No one really became a non-member. So, all of my tenure here, we've never had to charge anybody agency fee. And, you know, it was a chief here or a chief there that decided he didn't want to be a part of the union, and that's fine because we don't charge them anything because they don't have to retain membership.
What do you attribute this to, Bobby, that you haven't had that problem?
You know, for the most part, we try our best to take care of our firefighters, take care of our members. You know, it's not just about the traditional pay and benefits. We are also real, real big on firefighter safety, firefighter equipment. You know, we have sections in our contract that have to do with protecting firefighter safety, trying to get the right equipment for them to do their job. You know, and if we can't get the right equipment for them to do their job, it not only impacts their safety, but it impacts the service that we can provide to the public. You know, I was a firefighter for 36 years, so I'm not speaking as just a union guy. And we take a lot of pride as firefighters when we come to work and servicing the public. You know, that's what this job is all about. It's about helping people. And so, you know, anytime our member comes to us, we do our very best to assist them with whatever problems they have. We service them as best as we can, and we do our best to help them do their job if they feel there's any deficiencies.
Well, you know, Bobby, you raise a point about the kind of advocacy that a union does, because most people assume that their first thought about what a union does is pay and benefits. But
that's correct.
This is advocacy of a whole other area, I would think.
That is correct, and you're right. Most people just see unions as the pay and benefits and stuff like that. But for us, it's much more than that. And we police our own. You know, if we have problems with our firefighters, you know, we work with the employers to try and take care of that. For example, if you look at random drug and alcohol testing, that's something that we push, the union push, to put in place for our firefighters. The employers didn't want to do it way back in the beginning because that was a cost, that was money. But we felt it was important because if you got a firefighter working next to you, you want to make sure that person is not impaired. You know, so we do a lot to police our own, too.
Well, you know, one of the things that's being talked about in the aftermath of the Supreme Court decision is it a threat to the survival of public sector unions? But what you've been describing sounds like a pretty much a blueprint for keeping your union healthy.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I think the whole gist of this, it falls on somebody who doesn't want to be a union member, doesn't feel their union provides them any kind of benefit or service, and they don't want to pay dues. And for the most part, you know, for me anyway, the way I look at it, it's all about service. You know, granted, we have 2,000 active duty firefighters. We have 1,000 retirees that still choose to retain membership, and they don't have to. They're retired, you know, but we have 2,000 active duty firefighters. I would love to say I have 2,000, real happy firefighters, but it's hard to please 2,000 people. You know, so, you know, we do our best to do what's right, do what is fair, do what is bono, try and take care of the majority. And most people, if you're trying to do what's right, whether they like it or not, they understand it.
Bobby Lee is the president of the Hawaii Firefighters Association. Christian Fern, who's with us in our studio now, is the associate executive director of the University of Hawaii Professional Assembly. Christian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for this opportunity, Chris.
What was your take on this Supreme Court decision?
Our take was it was not a surprise. It was really a matter of the scope of the decision, and I think the decision went far and wide, and they tried to cover all bases that could have potentially come up before the Supreme Court in the future.
What kind of basis? You mean what issues?
I think the issue of opt-in, opt-out, that wasn't really an argument in the Janus case, but they did cover that in the decision, meaning that if a non-member, if there is a non-member, they need to affirmatively consent to being in a fair share agency fee payer. as opposed to
having it be automatic.
Having it be automatic, correct.
Which it has been for a great many public sector unions, right? That was the whole reason that Janus sued in the first place.
That is correct, yes.
What's the situation for your union, for UPA?
Well, we've been planning for this actually for the past 3 years. The prior case, the Friedrichs versus the California Teachers Association case, mm-hmm. very similar arguments. That ended up in a 4-4 split as a result of Justice Scalia's passing. Mm-hmm. And so we've been preparing for that since 2015, 2016. We just weren't sure exactly what the decision would yield. So now we have a direction to move in.
Do you think, as you were anticipating the Supreme Court decision, were you seeing it as part of maybe an anti-union wave in the country?
We did believe that primarily because there were no specific arguments in the case. Everything was conjecture, stating that everything that the public sector unions do is political. Mm-hmm. In the past, we've had to account for our political activity. And for example, UHPA over the past 5 years, it's ranged anywhere from 8 to 13% of dues dollars have gone to political activities. So to say that everything the union does is political was kind of it was not a fair argument.
Well, it came up, as you heard in the previous discussion with Bobby Lee from the firefighters, and there does seem to be some argument to be made in that direction that a union is a very, high-profile advocacy organization. If you disagree with it, you might not be able to get your voice heard as readily.
I mean, I understand that argument, but every year non-members are sent a notice. In the past, it was called the Hudson Notice, where they could get reimbursed for any the percentage of political activities that the union took part in the prior year. So I think there was already an avenue for people who did not believe in the political leanings or the direction mm-hmm. that the union was going in for them to get reimbursed for their own beliefs.
Do you feel that you're not going to be hurt by this decision?
I mean, we will be hurt. It's going to force the union to look at being more efficient in the manner in which we do our business. But there are pathways for us to move forward and proceed and continue representing the members of the faculty at the university.
How will you be hurt?
Well, immediately.
Decline in membership?
There's always that potential. Some of the articles by The Economist are stating that, of course, people, if there's an opportunity to get something for free, they will. We will continue representing all bargaining unit members, meaning all of the faculty members in bargaining unit 7, with respect to collective bargaining and contract negotiations. But when it comes to things like filing grievances, representation in arbitrations or litigations, the court decision did leave a pathway for us to charge for those services. And so if you're a non-member, non-fair share or agency fee payer, you can have the services of the union, but you will need to pay for it.
And those services could get, if you get into any kind of a job dispute that gets litigated, those services could get pretty pricey.
It could. I think for arbitrations, I think if you get to that stage, it costs somewhere around $30,000.
Once you bring attorneys into the picture.
Correct.
And that's for one individual union member.
Yeah, and that's kind of the average cost. I mean, it could go upwards of that. So,
if you are a union member, do you get represented without additional charge?
If you're a union member, you continue paying the union dues. There will be no additional charge for the services that we provided yesterday, or I should say the day before. Moving forward, you will continue to receive those services.
How do you, I would think that would take some careful crafting of your message to future employees of the University of Hawaii, for example, letting them know as they come in, these are your choices.
Yes. But like I said, we've been working on different pathways, and it was really dependent upon the specific decision on deciding on how to move forward. So we had a plan in place, and so we believe our pathway will be something that we can move forward with.
You know, the gist of Bobby Lee's argument, the president of the Hawaii Firefighters Association, the interview we just did, essentially was, if we continue to provide services beyond the wage and benefits package that are traditionally associated with unions, that we'll be all right. Do you see something similar for University of Hawaii Professional Assembly?
The largest portion of our costs go to representation. So whether a member calls in and just has a simple question on the regarding the contract, or wants some assistance in determining how to, you know, get some sort of dispute resolution, I think that is a service that a lot of members perhaps may take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
But those who do receive those services see the benefits. For example, in 2017, I think we took in roughly upwards of 300 member calls, grievances, et cetera, which is roughly 10% of our total membership.
Mm-hmm.
So that really occupies the majority of our time.
So you don't want to be in the union until you need one, right?
That seems to be the tenor of many of the arguments.
Christian, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Christian Fern is the Associate Executive Director of the University of Hawaii Professional Assembly. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, touting the benefits of cannabis-derived treatments for seizures. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking back at the life of one of Hawaii's cultural treasures. She grew up at a time when the arts and culture of pre-contact Hawaii were in disfavor and were widely suppressed. She was blessed to be a part of a family that cherished the old ways and rejected the notion that the old ways should be allowed to die off. Her aunt Keahi was a guiding force in her life, teaching her to dance and even pulling her out of Kamehameha schools because of what her aunt saw as the school's overemphasis on the ways of the missionaries. She was born in Napo'opo'o in 1915 and began her lifelong study of hula at age 4 under her aunt's tutelage. She became a kind of guardian to the ancient traditions of hula and was credited with almost single-handedly keeping it alive for future generations. There's a statue of her in the foyer of the Hilton Hawaiian Village to remind visitors that there's more to the traditions of the hula than they might have gleaned from Waikiki shows. Who was she? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Anna O'Brien's in Honolulu, with live music and featuring Comedy U on Wednesday nights. IrishPubHawaii.com.
When Lieutenant Governor Shan Tsutsui resigned to join a mainland-based public relations firm called Strategist 360, people in Hawaii wondered what the company was up to, especially in the political arena. They're still wondering. The company has been notably close-mouthed about its clients and the issues it will support, but some of their recent hires might offer some hints, as reporter Nathan Eagle tells us in today's reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat. Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning.
Most of us, I don't know if this is true, if you heard the term Strategy 360 for the first time when Shan Tsutsui announced his resignation.
It was a first for me to hear the firm's name. Not so much for a couple of my editors. Jim Simon's from Seattle, which is where Strategies 360 is from, so he was quite familiar with the firm and its work there.
Mm-hmm. What's their work going to be in Hawaii? How much can we glean from what we've heard so far?
Not too much in terms of specifics. They've declined to name any of their clients, at least at this point, because of non-disclosure agreements. But they did tell me that they're going to be working in some of the firm's specialty areas, which is healthcare, education, environment. But in talking to the CEO, Ron Dotsauer, he said, they've pretty much touched every sector of the economy in one way or another.
Usually, PR firms aren't shy about talking about the issues that they're supporting, right? Is this unusual?
Yeah, usually it's all about the client and let's, go after or go ahead and promote them in every way we can. But this is a little bit more behind the scenes.
What do you think that bodes for, especially in the political arena?
Well, it's anyone's guess in a way. I'm hoping that when the next campaign spending reports are due July 12th, we might get some more clues on any specific races they might be involved in. But again, the CEO said, I'm trying to get out of the political arena in terms of helping specific candidates get elected and instead advocate maybe more for different private clients that need to navigate that political process.
Your interview, it looks as if it was a pretty interesting interview with him, but it was short on specifics.
Yeah, indeed. It was a good interview. He's as candid as I think he could be or wanted to be, but still left with a lot of questions over who exactly they're representing and what the kind of end goal is.
Well, what can we glean, for example, from the hiring of John White, who came over from the Pacific Resource Partnership, which has, been heavily politically involved in recent years?
Well, with a guy like John White, who's heading the operations here in Hawaii, and some of the others he's brought on board, Stacey Alomar, Molly Pierce, both have PRP and Forward Progress connections, that is a group that is connected, completely with the Hawaii Carpenters Council, the group of unionized carpenters, as well as a lot of contractors. So we can expect them to probably be advocating for those kind of building interests, assuming that they are actually a client.
Well, they were behind Yes to Rail, right? So we can make an educated guess about their position on rail.
Right, absolutely.
It's unusual for somebody as like Shan Tsutsui. Usually when you get up to the point of being lieutenant governor, the next step is the top spot. And in the past, lieutenant governors have ended up as governors. It seemed unusual for him to leave the political arena completely for a PR firm that most of us in Hawaii hadn't heard of.
Absolutely. I think it shocked a lot of folks when he stepped down in January to join Strategies 360. We thought, okay, maybe he's going to run for mayor of Maui or pursue the governorship, but absolutely not. And we have seen him out campaigning for Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa and her effort to become next governor, but the CEO of Strategies says that's not one of their clients.
It's a communications firm that is very careful about what it communicates.
Indeed.
Thanks very much, Nathan.
Appreciate the time.
That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's reality check. To read the full story, you can visit civilbeat.org.
HPR's Legacy Society members are ensuring the vitality of this station far into the future. How? By including HPR in their wills or trusts. While making this valuable contribution, these donors are also taking advantage of federal and state tax laws that may allow reduction of income taxes, lower gift and estate taxes, or provide income during their lifetime. To find out how HPR can be part of your legacy, please call us during office hours. And thanks.
It's a step forward for the Food and Drug Administration's approach to cannabis-derived medications. This week, it approved a new drug, Epidiolex, that is a formulation of cannabidiol, CBD for short, to treat rare and severe forms of epilepsy. Wendy Gibson is a field organizer for the Drug Policy Forum and the Medical Cannabis Coalition of Hawaii, who has spent years advocating for the use of cannabis-derived medications. And although she has reservations about this one, she welcomes the FDA's changing attitude.
Many things are different now about using CBD. I would be surprised if people haven't heard about CBD oils, have been exposed to it in the health food stores. There is an entire project called Project CBD dedicated just to teaching people about CBD, and because it has many, many therapeutic uses.
So it's a derivative of cannabis, but it's not one that has psychic effects?
They say it's not psychoactive. However, it does buffer out the psychoactive effects of THC and therefore does have psychoactive effects. But it's not intoxicating.
Okay.
Yes.
Who uses it and who can benefit from it?
There are many people who are using CBD oils to treat many, many conditions because it's, well, the United States government, the Department of Health and Human Services has a patent on it as a neuroprotective agent. One of the uses is epilepsy. People are using it as an anti-inflammatory. People are using it as part of their cancer treatments, as an anti-nausea, also anti-proliferative, so it keeps the cancer cells from growing and tumors.
And it's now legal, right?
CBD from hemp is quasi-legal, and in the states that have medical cannabis programs, it's legal if it comes from a dispensary.
So it's legal in Hawaii?
Sort of. The CBD, so there's two kinds of cannabis sativa, and most people are buying the over-the-counter hemp kind. But the other kind, the medical kind, that is sold in the dispensaries is higher in THC. It's a high resin one. It has many more therapeutic chemicals in it than just the CBD from hemp.
So what has changed now in the legal environment regarding CBD?
Well, CBD is becoming more legal now for use. There are 29 states that have solid medical cannabis programs, and there are another 14 or so that have a CBD-only style medical cannabis program. And now with bringing in a pharmaceutical version of it, which is Epidiolex, we will now have at least the consideration by the government of getting it out of the Schedule I drug category, which is reserved for the most dangerous substances that have no medical value whatsoever. So that's progress. Just to get it out of the Schedule I drug category will make it less illegal.
As of today, it is in the Schedule I category?
It has been since 1970.
But it is that way today?
It is a Schedule I drug. It is. Hemp got an exemption through a 2014 farm bill that they can provide CBD products and ship them interstate if it's for industrial or research purposes only, but not for medical purposes. So anybody selling it cannot make health claims about it.
So what you have in practice is people with, for example, epilepsy, mm-hmm. seizures, using a substance illegally. Is that right?
To some degree, yes. And there are families who are worried that CPS are going to come take their children if it's discovered that they're using CBD to treat their children.
But it's been going on for years.
Many, many years. Yeah, we have medical refugee families here in Hawaii. These are families who have fled from other states that don't allow for the use of CBD or other cannabis products. And it's becoming more legal. And we're hoping that because Epidiolex the pharmaceutical is likely to be scheduled in a much lesser category, probably less than Schedule 2, probably a Schedule 3 category, which is still a controlled substance, mm-hmm. but not thought to be the most dangerous chemical on the planet, as it is in a Schedule 1 drug category.
How did you become a, how would you put it, cannabis educator?
I was inspired by many things, actually. When I was in nursing school, I took a class called Issues and Trends, and it was basically a debate class, and I chose medical cannabis as my topic, and the teacher told me that someone had already taken the pro stance, I would have to take the con, and so I thought that was a good challenge. I wanted to know everything that was wrong with it, mm-hmm. and so I found a brochure that the Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii put out is outlining Hawaii's medical cannabis laws, and what I discovered was the plant itself wasn't dangerous, but patients really needed a lot more advocacy from nurses, from the healthcare professionals about using their medicine and getting access to their medicines.
Do you see the, you know, there's clearly a movement toward greater acceptance of cannabis in medical uses. Do you see that continuing?
I think people are finally getting it, that patients aren't all about getting high, they're about getting well. And it's there are some people who will never get it, that are always going to, you know, challenge us and say, oh, you know, everybody's just trying to get high. But we've worked with enough patients. We've seen enough amazing successes with using this medicine that we're going to stand firmly behind our patients.
It must be difficult to work with patients when what they're doing is illegal.
Well, like you said, here in Hawaii, it's been accepted as a medicine since the year 2000. And we just got the dispensary bill passed in 2015, and we now have, I think, 8 dispensaries open. So patients can now have medicines that are tested and can be dosed, yeah, which is one of our greatest challenges was dosing this.
So we're seeing some genuine progress in your area, it would seem.
Well, sort of. Epidiolex has some concerns for us. We're thrilled that they're finally recognizing...
Epidiolex being the pharmaceutical equivalent? Or?
Yes, the pharmaceutical CBD cannabidiol. Okay. That was just approved yesterday. Mm-hmm. So we will be seeing that on the pharmacy shelves. And this is the first drug ever to be approved to treat Dravet syndrome, which is a rare type of seizure disorder. Epidiolex is only approved to treat 2 types of rare seizure disorders, so it's not a huge patient population that's going to benefit from this, but it's a good step in the right direction.
Does it address epilepsy?
Oh, yeah. The clinical trials had very good success rates with patients getting good reduction of seizures, but also what concerns us is the side effects. They were giving these patients high doses. The carrier is sesame oil. One of the side effects is diarrhea, and we think that might have been caused because of just high doses of sesame oil. But other patients were taken out of the program. I spoke with some of the parents of children who were involved in the Epidiolex study, and one mother pulled her daughter out because of the elevated liver enzyme side effect. And so she put her daughter on a hemp-derived CBD oil that has a little bit of THC in it, and she still got good results with it without the liver inflammation, without the liver enzyme.
So you're not recommending the pharmaceutical alternative. What do you think is the best way to deal with a seizure disorder?
As an American Cannabis Nurses Association member, I'm an advocate for whole plant botanical extract medicines. I appreciate that they're trying to come up with a pharmaceutical version of it, but chemists are just trying to recreate a plant that it seems to be working pretty well for most of the patients that we're treating. So while I'm not opposed to pharmaceutical drugs, I would like to see whole plant medicines studied more extensively with all the components that work synergistically together rather than trying to parse out one or two to try to create the magic formula to treat over 700 conditions. I can't imagine how long the research is going to take to achieve that.
So just sticking with cannabis in its pure form would address a lot of the same issues without having to break it down into different pharmaceutical equivalents?
I believe so. I believe if we could get good controlled studies on whole plant medicine, we would be a lot further along in our protocols than we are.
Wendy Gibson is a field organizer for the Drug Policy Forum and the Medical Cannabis Coalition of Hawaii. In today's Backyard Quiz, we ask you for the name of a woman born in 1915 who is regarded as one of Hawaii's cultural treasures. The reverence for traditional hula that is so much a part of local culture today owes a great deal to her tireless championing of the dance during a time in history when it was rarely taught and was widely suppressed. She became a kumuhula under the guidance of Mary Kavena Pukui, among others, and was regarded as one of the most important figures in the history of the art form. She spent many years as the curator of the Hulihe'e Palace in Kailua Kona and was a longtime advisor to the Merry Monarch Festival, which to this day honors the memory of Iolani Luahine. And a great many callers were ready to answer to honor her memory, but our friend Mike May was the first. Congratulations, Mike. And that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, providing opportunities for students' summer reading with Achieve 3000 Hawaii Home Access, wishing students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
They're like jewels in a crown. Maui's rare silver sword plants shine in the pristine setting of the high elevations of Haleakala. And it's been 6 months since scientists began trying to increase the numbers of this unusual species throughout the national park. It was a response to a recent study that found the population had plummeted over the last 20 years in response to climate change. Catherine Cruz filed this story about the effort to find the best conditions for growth as drier and hotter conditions are forecast.
Texas resident Tim Landon has been visiting Hawaii for more than two decades. He regularly makes a trek up Haleakala to check on Maui's silver swords.
Came up here, brought some friends to see the silver sword plants, just kind of excited to show them that because I just think those are fantastic. And just that it's just so unique, and the fact that it only blooms once and then dies, but it's just absolutely beautiful. Just to see the silver in the sides of the mountain, everything like that, it's just absolutely gorgeous.
Hi, my name is Melinda DeVito. I'm from Chicago, so we're here to see the island, and we just reached the summit. It's beautiful, and we're really excited to get a chance to see the park and enjoy Hawaii.
Yeah, you see the silver swords, one of a kind.
We heard that they reflect the sun, which is kind of neat. We're wondering how they photosynthesize if they do that.
Charles Lasseter of the National Park Service says there are strict safeguards in place to protect the precious plants.
I remember at one time people used to bring them down off the mountaintop ages ago.
That is correct. Ages ago, that was actually a very common practice. Today, it is, of course, strictly forbidden, and that is strictly enforced. So people can take all the pictures, and that's what we ask, you know, take only pictures, leave only footprints, take only pictures. We strictly enforce for people not to do any damage to any of the flora or fauna here in the park.
Our visit to Haleakala prompted us to circle back with University of Hawaii researcher Paul Krushelitsky about his recent attempts to outcrop the silver swords, looking for the most ideal growing conditions on the mountain. He checks in on the progress at Haleakala at least once a month and recalls the first time he set his eyes on the silver swords.
It's such a striking plant, right? I mean, when I first arrived in Hawaii, I was a volunteer at Haleakala National Park, and I think my first weekend there, I hiked through the crater, and I was just blown away by this crazy-looking plant. You know, it's this completely silver leaves, this big round ball, and then it just sends up this amazing flowering stalk once in its life. So it's, you know, it's really hard for people not to be drawn and fascinated by it. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why it has been studied so much over the decades, and that's why we know so much about it. And why we're able to actually have a pretty good understanding of what's happening with it right now. So we've been instituting an experimental outplanting study where we're placing seedlings across a wide range of elevations and precipitation just to try and see where these plants seem to be doing better and where they're doing worse. And that'll give the park and its collaborators a better idea of where we'll be able to more successfully propagate the plants in the future if parts of their range become unsuitable. Water for the park is provided by a catchment system, but the plants were not watering at all. We're relying on the natural conditions, and that's realistic in the future. I mean, most of the park is not easily accessible. We're talking about backcountry wilderness areas, and so the plants need to be able to survive on their own. And so that's why we're trying to find those locations in the park that they may have greater success, and including areas where they're outside their current range. So these plots we're putting in, most of them are outside where the plants currently exist, but are actually within their historic range. So they used to occur in some of the North Slope areas, and have disappeared from there probably because there used to be goats and cattle that ranged through there. But we want to look at those places again now because they're a little bit wetter than where the plants currently occur in the sort of central western crater and summit area, and see if that additional rainfall might be able to counteract some of the warmer temperatures that they're experiencing.
Right, so you're looking for just the more ideal growing conditions.
Exactly.
And so I know there's a delicate balance. You've got the pollinators up there, the yellow-faced bees, I think. And so how does that all work? I mean, because those have, I guess, certain threats too.
Yeah, so statewide, the bees have experienced also dramatic declines. A lot of the species haven't been seen in many years, are presumed extinct. They actually used to be one of the most common insects, apparently, throughout the islands in the early 20th century. But since then, a lot of habitat conversion and other threats from invasive species have really decimated those populations. And we now actually have 7 of the native Hylaea species, the yellow-faced bee species, are listed as endangered. Fortunately, none of those occur up in the park. And so the bee populations up in silver sword habitat are some of the most robust anywhere in the state. So right now, the pollination services they're receiving seem to be adequate, although we are concerned about one of these invasive species threats that I mentioned with the Argentine ant invading the park. It does seem to impact the bees pretty severely. So far, it doesn't really overlap with the silver sword range very much, but it is spreading in the park, and so that is a future concern that, in addition to climate change, we could be facing a threat in the form of reduced pollination services. And because silver swords are completely reliant on insect cross-pollination, they're self-incompatible, that would present a serious threat.
How did these ants get up there? Are they just hitchhiking on our cars and our boots?
Yeah, something like that. We don't know for sure in most cases, but they were first seen in the park around 1970. And have been spreading ever since. And we have been able to pretty strongly link the reduced rainfall that's occurred on the top of the mountain over the last few decades with about a 60% decline in the population. So That's very worrying. If that trend continues, that would be catastrophic. So we don't know what the future precipitation regime is going to be. Unfortunately, that's one of the most the areas that has the highest uncertainty when climate scientists in Hawaii are trying to predict what the future climate's going to be. You know, we're pretty sure temperature is going to increase. I mean, more than pretty sure. But when it comes to rainfall, it's really hard to predict what's going to happen 50 or 100 years from now, and especially because with the complex terrain we have in Hawaii, it's really difficult to sort of downscale those predictions and have a lot of confidence about what the rainfall is going to be in a specific area, like, say, the Silver Sword habitat.
Right, and that's the kind of magical thing about Hawaii. You've got all these incredible ecosystems that are just home to so many species, but so many of them are endangered or threatened.
Yeah, and they have these. A lot of them have these very narrow niches. They only occur in a small area, and so if something changes in those areas, it can be difficult for them to find another suitable area. And so that's one of the big concerns we have about climate change in Hawaii is how these species are going to be able to adapt to changes and what they've been experiencing.
If we look high atop Haleakala and we look down in the ocean at the coral. I know we've had stressors with the coral where we've had bleaching, or just unprecedented numbers of bleaching in recent years. But I know the scientists that study the coral there that say, well, it's not necessarily a bad thing because sometimes the species can become more resilient because of those stressors. What doesn't kill you, right? It makes you stronger. So is that like that with the endangered species up at the mountain?
Well, there's several different ways that could play out. I think one sort of mechanism that you're alluding to is selection for sort of hardier stocks. And it's hard to know whether any particular species is going to be able to evolve quickly enough to deal with the pace of change. I mean, it all depends on what that pace is. In most cases, I feel like most scientists believe that evolution isn't going to be able to occur quickly enough to deal with the pace of climate change, but that's going to vary from species to species and situation to situation. Whether they can respond in other ways, just through their changes in their development, it's going to depend on the situation and the species. So it's a little hard to say across the board what's going to happen that way. The species that everyone in Hawaii cares about. It's an iconic species. A lot of the visitors come up to the park just to see it. People come from around the world just to see it. And so the park itself is taking this very seriously, and they're very concerned, and they've been really supportive in this research to try and figure out, hey, what can we do about this so that, we don't just watch this happen, that we can maybe figure out some solutions. And that might provide ideas for other species that we don't have as much information on, and so we don't have as good a handle on and how they may be responding to changing conditions.
So you're not depressed about the state of the Silver Sword?
I try not to get too depressed. Fortunately for this species, there's still quite a few of them out there, and so we're not down to the last handful of species last handful of individuals like we are for a lot of other plant species in the state. So in that sense, we're doing quite a bit better, and we have a little bit of time and leeway to try and figure things out. For a lot of other species, they're in even more dire circumstances.
Right. So this is maybe a good model.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah. So Malama the Silver Sword.
Exactly. <yeah.
laughs> Okay. All right. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
That was UH researcher Paul Krushelitsky talking with Catherine Cruz on her recent trip to Haleakala. For links to find out more about the research on silver swords, you can check out our conversation webpage. There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. And Derek, we're in mango season, am I right?
Yes, we are. And this weekend, you can celebrate the fruit at Mango Jam Honolulu. It's a free two-day festival. The event includes a live entertainment food booth. It's offering mango-inspired dishes, a pop-up bar with mango drinks, local vendors, arts and crafts, plus a farmer's market and more. And this is happening Friday, tomorrow, from 5:30 to 9 p.m., and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. at the Frank Fossey Civic Center grounds. Downtown.
All things mango.
All things mango, yes.
And we've got a full moon coming up.
You can take a walk under the full moon Friday on the north shore of Oahu. Waimea Valley's Moonwalk is back for its 35th year. The full moon in June is typically known as the full strawberry moon or the full rose moon and the lotus moon. Admission times for this moonwalk are 8 and 8:30 p.m. tomorrow. Each admission begins with a chant and brief Waimea Valley overview, and you must exit the valley no later than 10 p.m. tomorrow.
And then also tomorrow, there's a Friday town party on Lanai.
This party will feature over 25 vendors set up around Dole Park, including food booths and restaurants serving up local food, as well as several music and entertainment venues. Lanai's Friday town party is from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. tomorrow in Dole Park.
Great, Derek. Thank you. Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Power dynamics shape everything in our lives. From high school...
You're wearing sweatpants.
So?
So that's against the rules, and you can't sit with us.
To the U.S. Senate.
The senator will take her seat.
To the way we feel about ourselves.
Power does make us a little bit more self-focused, but this can happen to us all. This is just what the mind does when we feel powerful.
This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, a longtime Chinatown business owner looks at recurring safety issues in a troubled neighborhood. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave your comment. And the number to do that is 808-792-8217. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.